Hello and welcome to The Price of Football. Hopefully, fingers crossed, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And like David De Gea's post-match press conference yesterday, Kieran, neither of us are going to accept responsibility for somehow mislaying the episode for it. So it turns out producer guy does have a purpose after all, which is uploading stuff to the internet. But you tapped it with a hammer and it was all fine.
Yes, it was somehow Monday's show went out on Thursday as well. And fair play to our listeners, they were straight onto it. I've spoken to our new engineer, and he said it's something to do with the cash. That's been the story. That's been our problem with producer guy from day one.
Yeah.
To be fair, but I think if you reload your cash, then you can listen to us talking about our result. With Barnsley, you know, within hours of us going studs deep on the Barnsley decision to tie up with some hex.com, that they binned off the sponsor.
Yeah, we're taking responsibility for that. We take responsibility for some things, Kieran, but it's nice to know that we're such a part of your routine, everybody, that you mildly panicked when we weren't there at the right time. Some of you are less sympathetic than others. Like most of the tweets are, I say, chaps, have you realised what's going on? But there were quite a few saying, come on, fix it. I don't pay £1 a month, the Patreon, to not listen at 9 o'clock in the morning when I normally do. Thank you for your lovely little support. It's very, very gratefully received. And I'm sure Guy appreciated having to take half an hour off his beach in Portugal to sort it out. Questions day, Kieran. And we have some good questions. And our first question comes from, and I was really excited,
yes.
It comes from Brian Clough. Lee. Brian Clough Lee. It's what a great name.
I just
for the moment when I read it, I thought, where is it? Finally, he's contacted us from beyond the grave. But it's a great name, Brian Clough Lee, and it's a good question. Brian Clough Lee has been wondering about option to buy clauses that often seem to be a part of player loan deals. Now, say a club wants to activate a clause like this and buy a player at the end of a loan period, is the player obliged to go along with it? The club can't force him to sign permanently, presumably, so the decision-making must end up back with the player and his agent, which surely undermines the advantage of having this kind of clause in the first place.
Yes, I think what would happen under these circumstances is that when the player first has negotiations with the potential new employer, they will then agree potential terms. So everything tends to be sorted out in advance between all of the parties. Yeah, they do have to like each other. And if the buying club wants to trigger the option to buy, the advantage to them is they have a fixed price. So if the player has performed really well, then at least, you know, you potentially, you might be getting a £50 million player for £20 million. Personal terms are a separate issue. So the player could refuse to go, but normally I think that would have been part of the initial negotiations between all the parties.
And we have a similar, it's not a similar question, it's got similar words in it. So if I was to say that about every question, it'd all be similar, wouldn't it? So we've all got a question mark at the end. They're all exactly the same. It's from Luke, this question. Arguably my favourite apostle, Kieran. but again, as with Brian Clough Lee, I suspect it's not that Luke. I suspect it's definitely not that Luke. Why do clubs put massive buyout clauses on players? This just puts off other clubs, which I know it's meant to, but then most of the time the contract expires anyway and they go for free. Surely putting in a lower clause would entice clubs to try and buy a player to get some money before they do go for free. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think Luke's right to an extent in that some of the buyout clauses are there as a preventative measure. And also they're testing the water. So I think, you know, most famously, Barcelona had this, you know, €220 million buyout clause in Neymar's contract, and they put that there, safe in the confidence that nobody would pay it. And then PSG came along and says, "Hold my beer," and they agree to pay. And I think there's one or two players now that have got buyout clauses of $300-500 million. Now, part of that is to get a bit of publicity, but it is there to try provide some form of protection. As far as the player going to the end of his contract, well, if you get 5 good years out of the player, then the club that's bought the player is normally quite happy. And just because you have a buyout clause, the buyout clause means that you have to consider the offer, or it could be as little as you have to inform the player that a bid has been made. So I think the most famous one of these was in respect of Luis Suarez and Liverpool and Arsenal. And Suarez had a clause in his contract which says if Liverpool receive a bid of more than £40 million, then they're duly obliged to say, oh, by the way, Louis, somebody's been inquiring about you. Whereas under normal circumstances, it could be kept private between the two clubs. So Arsenal did make that inquiry at £40 million plus £1. John Henry went off and sort of, you know, he I think he said, what are they smoking when that bid came in, which is a strange thing to come from a septuagenarian commodities trader. And Liverpool said, okay, well, we've advised you, but we're not accepting the offer. So they could have kept quiet. I think a lot of this is to do with publicity and trying to get messages out to fans via the media and so on. But in respect of the clauses themselves, that they are a protective measure. They can also act, of course, in the benefit of the player. So we've just seen Haaland move to Manchester City for, it was a €60 million buyout clause. That's what his agent agreed when he first moved to Dortmund. And that was to protect the player, because everybody thought this lad is going to be quite frightening in a few years' time. His market value, 150, 200 million, Manchester City got him at a bargain price.
Not according to Paul Merson yesterday. Not yesterday, it's Saturday, isn't it? He was very scathing about the fact that he only had 7 touches in the entire game. There you go. I was just trying to work out what the French would be for hold my beer. I'm so nervous now about the internet, Kieran. I don't dare Google anything in case I lose either the script on one machine or the Zencastr on the other, basically. But hold my beer sounds better, doesn't it? And also, Kieran, it wasn't just Barnsley. But you mentioned Barcelona. They sort of got their acting gear after you gave them a bit of a sledging as well, because they started that very afternoon, they started registering players left, right and centre.
Yes, they triggered their fourth economic lever, and yeah, I've been through Investopedia, I've been through quite a few of my textbooks as well on the world of finance. Economic lever is a unique phrase. It's a payday loan, isn't though?
Talking of beer, this is a tenuous thing, but it just reminded me. I went from beer to pie. You were back at the Amex yesterday. You're very excited, I noticed, Kieran, about the guest pie. Very excited.
Well, it's just good to see that our friends at Piglets are back and they're providing quality. So minced beef, bacon, and cheddar is an absolutely fantastic combination, and it's only available this month. Unless sales are splendid, in which case you might be able to try one out, because Palace are coming to the Amex, not too far away.
Yeah, but we have a policy of not buying stuff there.
So, oh, right.
Basically, yeah, just not putting money in your pocket. And that, unfortunately, so childish, that extends to day trips to Brighton. While everyone else in the family is tucking into fish and chips, I'm not taking the risk that the bloke doesn't support Brighton. not spending £8 on a bit of cod from a Brighton fan. Ian McLaughlin, which of course is my mother's maiden name, God rest her soul, the woman who put the laugh into McLaughlin. Ian McLaughlin is a Leeds United fan. And he says, last season my team had a warehouse clearance sale. Aside from the usual items, 4x XL sizes of shirts from past seasons, the majority was what the club would refer to as official merchandise, Adidas and Kappa t-shirts that have had a club badge bunged on them somewhere. There were boxes and boxes of this stuff, and the Kappa items were from at least 2 seasons ago. My question is, does the club have to pay for this stock? If so, what's the benefit of waiting up to two seasons later before trying to sell it for £5 or £10 a pop? I suspect they're not waiting. They just haven't been able to sell it before. Why don't the club just clear the deck at the end of each season instead of keeping tons of boxes in warehouses hoping someone will eventually buy it? Is there a financial benefit to selling it at a later date?
I think this is intriguing stuff here from Ian. A lot depends on whose responsibility is the club shop. So I believe that Chelsea's shop is actually run for them by Nike. So therefore, it's a Nike decision rather than that of the club. There are people such as, I think, Fanatics who run some of the club shops at other clubs and so on. So it does vary in terms of circumstances. I think Ian's absolutely right that having loads of boxes taking up space isn't great. In the case of Leeds, if you go to the Leeds account, and I'm sure many people have done exactly the same as I have on a Sunday morning, Leeds had £8.1 million worth of merchandise in their store and in their storerooms at the 31st of July 2021. So it is a risk. If you don't sell it, then during the season, it is actually quite difficult to sell last year's kit, and that's why we tend to have these so-called warehouse sales. A lot of clubs do have them, however, at the end of the season, after the final home match has taken place. And then you can effectively, if you want that 5XL shirt from two seasons ago, which you associate with some dismal away performances, it's available a bargain. And I know people are saying, because I've been doing a bit of work with some of the people involved in classic shirts, and the value of shirts, especially from the 80s and 90s, has gone through the roof. But the reason why they've gone through the roof is that it's now 2022, and the shirts are 40 years old, so they are sort of genuine antiques. Is there a financial benefit to selling it at a later date? It's because, in theory, you might have been able to sell it for £10 to £20 a little bit earlier, and now you're accepting £5 or £10. So you try to get as much money out as in terms of standard prices as you can, and then you have to go and accept what you think you can get away with.
I believe, and I know our listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, that I believe in the early 70s, Leeds were the first club to come up with a kit specifically to wear at away games, whether there was a clash or not. Remember that rather nice yellow kit with the blue thing? And I believe they wore that in every away match. But Kieran, how did you remind me how you know that they had £8 million worth of stock lying about?
Because I went into their accounts this morning at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Legally?
Yes, legally, yes. Right. Yeah, they are published as part of the annual reports which go to Companies House. Which, as you know, I'm never far away from Companies House.
Of course not. And, both spiritually and physically. But so that actually includes how much they've got in the club shop, in their accounts?
Yep. The merchandise at the end of the season is detailed for every club. I could probably put out a chart on Twitter in a few hours if I can be. Though the Baroness has just given me a look. I think I might perhaps not do that.
Oh, don't put people's hopes up, Kieran. You can't let your loyal fans down. So that £8 million of stock counts as an asset then, does it? Or
Yes, because you can sell it at a profit. The 8.1 million represents the cost to Leeds. So they'll have their markup on that, and they've got an interesting away kit this season. I don't think it's as classic as the old yellow Admiral one, which everybody at school used to like.
Tom Haywood has an interesting question. What kind of budgets do clubs allocate for psychologists and experts in really specific fields? For example, Liverpool's throw-in expert. This is a question we wouldn't have had 10 years ago. Are these often one-off fees, or would they be salaried? I assume as you go further down the table and down into the football pyramid, these budgets become smaller and smaller. Are there any anomalies? I don't think they come smaller and smaller as you go down the table. I doubt, for example, whether Tooten and Mitchum have got a throw-in psychologist. It's an interesting question, Kieran, and it is a new field because clubs at the top level are getting very specific coaches in, aren't they, to do these jobs?
Yes, this is all about marginal gains. And from the club's point of view, given that the difference between finishing 13th and 12th is 2.5 million. And the difference between finishing fifth and fourth could be up to 100 million because that's Champions League. The senior clubs are often putting these specialists onto the payroll because they will be working with the players on a day-to-day basis or a weekly basis. Or what you might have is you might say, well, we're going to employ you for 2 days a week. And often these people are working in, you know, other areas of sports science. It could be that they're working in universities and or as have their own practices. So certainly some clubs do employ them on a full-time basis. We also have a part-time basis, and some will be purely on a freelance. So you might have a sports psychologist that comes in once a month to have a chat to the players about their approach to the game and the benefits that can bring. And Tom's exactly right. It is determined by revenue, which is being generated by the club, and that dictates your ability to pay.
Yeah, I think Palace might need a sports psychologist before the big relegation six-pointer at Anfield tonight. Now, we've had a question from Luke, and here's a question from Jack, the lesser-known of the apostles. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John and Jack. After watching Deadline Day last season, says Jack, and I'm pause here to remind people that we prefer full names, if that's all right, unless you have a reason, in which case, do not worry. Just a number will do if you can't give us your full name. After watching Deadline Day last season, I noticed many deals where there are long-term loans with options to buy from teams from overseas. These deals seem very good financially for both the buying club and selling club. The buying club gets to look at the player after a longer period in the new league. So what ratio of the wages are the buying club, selling club covering for the loan period?
Well, it's I think it's a range. I think it's the politest way to describe that, right, Jack. And that range is 0 to 100%.
Oh, wow.
I hate to bring him up again, but Danny Drinkwater, by all accounts, Reading were paying 0% of his wages when he was on loan from Chelsea last season. I think Chelsea wanted to give him the opportunity to get some experience, and the coach says, well, you know, you're not really part of my plans. He had signed for 30 million from Leicester. He was on a very lucrative contract, and there were no takers. So Chelsea says, well, you know, we want to do the decent thing by the player. And also, you know, I've said this before, it means that you've not got an unhappy player moping around in training saying, I'm not in the squad this year. They're taking up physio space, they're taking up car parking space, they could be bitching with the players. It can be a negative if you've got unhappy players, so it does make sense. In other scenarios, especially in respect of some of the younger players, the acquiring club does pay 100% of the wages and potentially pays a loan fee as well. So you can actually recover more money and you get the benefit of a player who can make a difference to your team. Being younger, the player gets experience, and it's less common to have an option to buy under those circumstances. But, you know, quite often the acquiring club will try to negotiate, especially if you know, both parties agree that if the selling club's in the Premier League and this player's in League One or the Championship, and he's probably not going to go any further with the senior club, then it sort of locks both parties in.
I feel sorry for Danny Drinkwater. We went along for 2 years nearly without once mentioning him, and in the last few weeks, he's going to be sitting at home or in the pub with his friends and family, and going, "You're all right, Danny. I don't know what it is. My ears, they're really hot." People are going to say, "What is a heat wave?" He said, "No, it's more than that. It's just this kind of burning thing. I don't know. I just hope somebody's not mentioning my unfortunate loan period at Reading." So, sorry, Danny.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Matt, Matt Greenwood says, I was wondering, and talking of heat waves, I'm really excited because the little weather forecasting on my laptop just says thunderstorms.
Oh.
Yeah, great. Matt Greenwood says, I was wondering, with it's like a director's cut today, you're getting to find out what's going on as things happen. I also noticed I've taken issue of Eurostar here because it says on this advert 11 daily trains, and I think that should be 11 trains daily, but there you are.
Oh.
Yeah, well, somebody, I'm sure somebody who knows what the French for hold my beer is will be able to tell me whether I'm right or wrong with that. Matt Greenwood says, I was wondering, with sponsorship deals investigated or monitored to ensure they aren't overinflated, is there, or why isn't there, the same applied to transfers? I can imagine there's been some overinflated fees over the years which have some hidden reasons behind it. Now, that sounds to me, Kieran, Matt Greenwood might be being a little bit cynical. We wouldn't recognise that because we're not cynical ourselves. But it's an interesting point, Kieran, because I think most football fans look at a lot of football transfer fees and go, well, that's not right, is it? Surely, what's the reason behind that?
Yes, and I think Matt has highlighted two potential areas here. First of all is where we've got a couple of clubs with players who aren't delivering. And what the clubs don't want to do is to sell the players at a loss. So therefore you arrange a convenient swap arrangement. So I think if we take a look at Arsenal and Manchester United with Sanchez and Mkhitaryan, neither did particularly well. Or, Sanchez wanted to go. Mkhitaryan hadn't worked out at Manchester United. This was a way that Arsenal preserved a bit of face and acquired a player, and Manchester United got a player who was throwing his toys out of the pram at Arsenal. You've then got clubs wanting to be creative with the numbers. Now, we don't like to stick the boot in on Barcelona with regards to years and years of financial management mismanagement. But the swap of Arthur and Pjanic, which again, it's sort of a bit of a golden oldies this episode in terms of things which we have covered before. But the prices involved, I think those players were swapped with agreed prices of, I think it was 72 million and 60 million euros. But for players who were okay, if you're playing for Juve and Barca, you're not going to be crap. But everybody goes, well, they seem to be very, very high prices. And then he realised, hold on, it allows both clubs to register a big profit on the swaps of those players. Mm. And that counts towards financial fair play. Whereas when you're buying a player, our good old friend amortisation comes into the being and you spread the cost over 5 years. So there's always benefits if you're a selling club. So that's one area. And I think the other area which sort of Matt is alluding to is in respect of multi-club ownership. So if we take a look at the relationship between RB Salzburg and RB Leipzig, there have been 17 transfers, mainly from Salzburg to Leipzig in recent years. And the most recent one is in respect of a striker called Benjamin Sesko, who is...
If the new Haaland, take a look, according to some and they just rather both, lazy journalists.
Both happen to have the same broad owner.
That seems to have been very modest.
In Red Bull, even though the RBs, of course, don't stand for Red Bull in either case. If we look at Aaron Moy, he was a very promising player at Melbourne City. And people said, they think he's going to develop, become a decent player. He was transferred to Manchester City for nothing. And he never played for Manchester City, and in fact, if you Google Aaron Moy in a Manchester City shirt, I think you'll struggle to find one. Mm. He was immediately put out on loan to Huddersfield Town. Huddersfield Town then bought him for £10 million. That meant that Manchester City booked a profit of £10 million on the deal. That counts towards FFP. There's no equivalent of FFP as such in Australia. So can you see when you've got a multi-club ownership, this is a classic example of, we refer to this, and it's nothing to do with football in general, as transfer pricing. And we've seen similar. We know that the likes of Facebook and Google, they seem to book an awful lot of their profits in Ireland, where the rate of corporation tax is 12.5%, as opposed to the UK, where the rate of corporation tax is over 20%. That is, of course, by a pure coincidence, I hasten to add. But it does allow any organisation which operates in different markets to allocate profits, perhaps I'm being harsh here, to allocate profits and also to allocate costs in particular locations in order to satisfy local criteria and local laws.
Of course, it's coincidence, Kieran. Producer guy would like us to underline that, but it's handy, isn't it? It's a handy coincidence. It's one of them, special coincidences that come in handy. Just for newer listeners, Kieran, perhaps you can remind us how sponsorship deals are investigated or monitored, and why?
Well, following the acquisition of Newcastle by PIF last year, by pure coincidence, almost immediately afterwards, the Premier League introduced new rules in which every single commercial deal with a value of more than £1 million has to go to what they refer to as a fair value panel. So if Newcastle sign a deal for £40 million with a new sponsor, the fair value panel will go, we think it should be 12. And therefore, it's only going to be 12 that counts towards financial fair play. This does seem to have been rather hastily introduced. But in terms of votes, I believe it was 18 clubs voted for the change in the rules. Newcastle voted against, and Manchester City abstained, because I think they saw, this was an attempt by the elite to try to reduce competition. And the likes of the Glazers, they don't want competition for European places as far as the Champions League is concerned, and they see Newcastle as a threat, and that's why these rules were introduced.
Wow, if Danny Drinkwater's ears are burning this weekend, the Glazers' ears, my God. It's like cartoon flames coming off their ears. Ian Waterhouse has a question, Kieran, which is technically more a legal question than a financial one, but there are financial ramifications. But I want to ask it anyway, because it's an interesting story that probably needed to have more publicity. And Ian Waterhouse, his question relates to recent events at Barnet Football Club, in which some players alleged they were threatened with the sack if they went on strike in protest at their captain being suspended following allegations of racist abuse from fans during a game. It was reported that the Barnet chairman said the players were employed on standard FA playing contracts to participate in football matches, and any threats not to play would be a breach of their contract and would carry heavy sanctions with the National League. That's a quote. Ian says, my question concerning the above is, how does a standard FA playing contract differ from a bespoke contract between the player and their club or the league? And which of these two contracts take precedent if they contain different terms and conditions? Also, do players have the same rights as normal Joe Public over taking strike action?
Yes. I've tried to sort of dig up at what's happened in respect of this, because I believe that it wasn't just racist abuse from fans. I think it was racist abuse from a member of staff. And the captain said, "I'm not willing to get have anything to do with the person involved." And there was support from the other players. So in order to have a strike, you have to go through appropriate procedures. I am a member of a trade union. There would have to be a ballot, there would have to be a majority of people, voting for strike action, as we are currently seeing in other industries. All the players have the option of joining the PFA. And therefore what they would do is that they would have to seek guidance from the PFA as to the appropriate action they could take. But we also have to be practical about here. Football's a tough industry. If you're not feeling 100%, if you feel that there have been some racist related issues at your place of employment, the chances are you're not going to put in a proper shift. Because physically you might be able to, mentally, psychologically, you might feel uncomfortable, and that might have an impact. So, I always say to people under these circumstances, get around the table, negotiate, get the other side's point of view, good communication, be transparent, and so on. So the threats from the Barnet chairman certainly didn't help. In terms of, yes, there is an obligation to pay players, but I don't think that there would have been sanctions from the National League, because the PFA would have got involved on behalf of their members. And then, you know, it's a bit like my mate the Prowler, when we used to play on wickets which were, you know, which were baked as they are this summer. His hamstring always used to twitch as soon as he saw a wicket on which there was little chance of taking any wickets, because he was a man who was very conscious of his bowling average. And it'll be the same for football players. Yeah, well, you know, I've got my muscles feeling a little bit tight. I've got a bit of a niggle here. I can't play. And that's what could have been the reaction of the players if they didn't formally go on strike. You know, we've heard this, I think, in respect of the police a few years ago. There was going to be a day of blue flu, where a lot of police officers, you know, at one point were saying, well, okay, we're not going to formally go on strike if the government, you know, prevents us from doing so. But yeah, we might all get a severe attack of the sniffles simultaneously, purely by coincidence, of course.
Yeah, I've said this before, Kieran. I think the Prowler needs to be more aware of his nickname than his bowling average. To be perfectly honest, if anybody involved in this story, Barnet, National League, PFA, would care to get in touch and elaborate, this is clearly it's an important issue, then we'd only be too happy to hear what's gone on and what the long-term ramifications are, because it's obviously a concerning story. Our next question comes from Nick Andrews Govain, which is a cracking name, isn't it? So it's a double-barreled name, Nick Andrews Govain. And Nick's question is, what is the average spend by Premier League men's teams on their women's setup? And what would be the impact on the men's team if there was a rule that all Premier League teams have to invest a minimum of, say, 10% of their income on women's football?
Yes, in terms of budgets in the women's game here, and here I'm looking at wage budgets, the figures for 2021, which are on average probably up around about 50% since 2018-19, in the WSL were £1.3 million to £3.3 million for the season. Now, you've got individual players who are earning, you know, 15, perhaps £20 million in a season. So there is a significant difference. There's a significant difference between clubs in the WSL as well. It's a shame that Chelsea choose not to disclose their total wage bill for the women's team, because I suspect Chelsea's will be the highest budget. They certainly appear to have the highest paid player, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. But if we were to look at Nick's interesting question, that let's take 10% of the men's team's budget, has to be allocated to the women's team, then we would be looking at somewhere between 8 million to 35 million. So it would involve a substantial increase in terms of the pay available. You know, 35 million is what you'd normally expect for a club in the Championship, which is perhaps just been relegated from the Premier League and is perhaps in its second year of parachute payments. Or we've even seen some clubs pay in excess of that, when they got into the playoffs, or when they've got a new owner who's trying to get into the Premier League as quickly as possible. And that, you know, realistically, we'd be looking there at sort of wages of, you know, perhaps 20 grand a week, which is, million pounds a year. And our understanding, I think, is the highest paid player in the WSL is on 300,000. I think we've said this before. The average is 27. So I think it would be intriguing. I think the argument that the Premier League clubs would say is, well, under those circumstances, we will drop our women's team, because the women's teams at present are not generating 10% of the revenue of the men's team. So therefore, we're going to be operating at significant losses. And whilst those losses don't count towards FFP, that they're still losses that have to be borne either by the rest of the business or by the owner.
It is an interesting point from Nick. The one downside to it is that if all, not just Premier League teams, but if all men's teams were obliged to invest a minimum of, say, 10% of their income on the women's team, that does put a disadvantage teams like Durham, who don't have a men's team, for example. They're one of the few. So that would be unfair to them, wouldn't it, for a start?
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. And remember, we've also got clubs such as Lewis, where the women's team are on 100% of the men's team.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I'm still sulking a little bit, Kieran. I'm not in Scotland, as I love it up there so much. This is an interesting question, actually. It's from Kieran Fullop. And Kieran says, over the years, Rangers and Celtic have often had the same shirt sponsor. And I've wondered whether, when that happened, the clubs negotiated those deals together. And did the sponsor get some sort of discount? That's an interesting one, Kieran, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I think the dual sponsorship, CR Smith, which was double glazing, and then we had Tennent's as well. I think that was done from the benefit of the sponsors, that they wanted to have a club, one of the senior clubs in Glasgow, wearing their shirts every Saturday. And of course, given that both clubs don't play at home at the same, so this was a beneficial, and also that it was a bit of a defensive measure, because you mentioned earlier that you won't eat or drink in Brighton or buy anything at the ground, and I get that. Well, if you think you're militant, you're nothing compared to Rangers and Celtic fans. So can you see the potential for, I'm not going to get double glazing from WH Smith, so I'm going to move to another type of alcoholic beverage rather than Tennent's, because they are sponsoring my rivals. I think this was done from the sponsor's point of view, is that if they're sponsoring both clubs, they can't be subject to a boycott. They can't antagonise 50% of the population of Glasgow who are supporting those two clubs.
To save our listeners tweeting, Kieran, I don't think any of us are going to be getting our double glazing from WH Smith. you can get all sorts. You can get vouchers for a spa, and what you can't get mainly in WH Smith is blinking books these days. But you certainly can't get double glazing. Is Findlay after a walk? He seems to be rattling his lead. With some,
he just finished a wonky shot, so now he's having a stretch.
Oh, that's well, good. Eh? I'm glad he keeps fit. He's got to work that wonky jump off. Our final question comes from Ricky Prince, and Ricky Prince asks this: if a club goes out of business while still owing instalments on the transfer fee for a player, would the selling club have any recourse to reclaim that player's registration, as they never received full payment for it?
The answer to that, Ricky, is no, because if we take a look at clubs which have gone into administration and also some clubs which have gone out of business altogether, what happens is that following the appointment of an administrator or a liquidator, the administrator has to prioritise football debts, but it doesn't necessarily mean that 100% of them are going to be paid. And therefore, it is the player's registration certificate which is transferred, not the player themselves. The player signs a contract of employment with the new club, which is now in administration, and that effectively locks the player in. So that actually can benefit the player, because what happens if you've gone from Club A, where you on 10 grand a week, to Club B, who are paying you 40 grand a week? Club B go into administration. It doesn't mean that you therefore have to go back and accept 10 grand a week from your previous employer, who probably doesn't want you anyway. So remember that football debts are a preferential creditor, so they are paid ahead of other classes of creditor, but the contract itself is maintained by the club in administration, which in turn the administrators might try to sell that contract onto somebody else to recoup some of the money to get the club out of the mess that it's in.
Now, Kieran, we'll be back on Thursday with our regular news pod, hopefully. The reason I say it with some trepidation is, as producer guy went away on his holiday, he sent what I can only describe as a breezy email with the template.
Threatening was the word I used.
With the template for the script, which just says, fill in the news stories yourself. Because obviously I can't predict what's going to happen. So basically, at some stage over the next couple of days, he trusted us to. So it will happen. It just some of the news stories might be about 70s cartoons. That's all. rather than let's keep our fingers crossed that something happens. Maybe Eurostar will get in touch to say they are right. It should be daily trains. But we will be back on Thursday. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to join them and make a small monthly contribution to the pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you pay enough, you can avoid the adverts. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, apologies for the technical issues that arose on Thursday. When my private message, direct messages on Twitter started pinging at, I think the first one I got was at 3:20 a.m.
Wow.
Which I thought, yeah, we've got some very committed listeners. But then I realised the show is listened to sort of quite globally for reasons which still confuse us. But Patreon is one way. The other way that you can show a bit of positive vibes for the show is by going on to your podcast app and giving us a review. If you give us 5 stars, apparently it's the stars that matter, according to Guy and his understanding of the algorithm, which I think is fair to say is slightly ahead of that of Kevin and I when it comes to understanding the algorithm. But it doesn't matter what you say. You could say you would rather have the show presented by Jermaine Greer and Dennis Wise, which I think would be a clash of minds. I think it'll be an interesting conversation. I certainly would sit down and listen to that, because they might have alternate views.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.